Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute, Edelman's think tank for advancing the study and measurement of trust in institutions. Welcome to a three-part series of the show where we will be recording on the ground from the 2024 annual meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Over the next few days, we will be speaking with key figures and experts about this year's forum and gather their insights on our annual 2024 Trust Barometer. I'm joined today by Bronwyn Maddox, CEO of Chatham House. Also known as the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House is a London-based think tank that helps people, societies, and government understand and adapt to change. In addition to leading Chatham House, Bronwyn is a visiting professor of policy at King's College London. Bronwyn, welcome to the Trustmakers.
Great to be here.
So we're now in the midst of Davos, of the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum. How's it going so far for you?
It's great. It's busy. People are speculating. Are there fewer professional services firms? The tech firms are here big time. But there is a backdrop of the world being in really quite a grim time. And the Middle East has broken onto the agenda really rather late in the day. The agenda from the geopolitical side still very much dominated by the US and China and Ukraine. And then the sense of the Middle East, if you like, being shoehorned in at the last minute. It is very much a reminder that things don't stop happening. But I would say that for all the gloom and tension that there is around geopolitics and the economics, there is actually a lot of optimism here, and it is more on things like tech, on medicine, on healthcare, even possibly on the environment, and the politics at least are dealing with the environment. So it's not completely a gloom fest.
And would you say that it depends who you're speaking to in terms of it being gloom and optimism, or are you speaking to a lot of people who are both gloomy and optimistic?
I would say that politicians are much more cautious than business people who are seeing the opportunities. I don't mean just the opportunities in a troubled world, because most business people say they want a degree of certainty, but they are seeing the opportunities coming through in innovation, and that's what they want to talk about. And I do hope that when we look back at these years, as well as these very dramatic political events that we've seen, we will think of it as a time of creativity in science, in medicine, in tech, because that's also what people want to talk about.
And do you feel that government leaders at all share that passion for creativity when it comes to tech and other innovations?
They're trying. They know they should talk about it. So we heard in the opening speeches of the conference, first from the Chinese Premier and then from Ursula von der Leyen, in the European Union, we heard very prominent mentions given to AI and the kind of difference that it might make for societies. And that was very much a sort of statement of each piece. And that was quite a lot of the Chinese speech. But the European speech then veered back to talking about the many things facing Europe, one of which is the conflict in Ukraine.
We launched the Edelman Trust Barometer here at Davos, and one of the findings is people want government to further regulate innovation, but at the same time, they think government leaders don't even understand the innovations that they're trying to regulate. Do you find that in your conversations with government?
Yes. And I think if you say something, as one of our panelists did recently at Chatham House, to the politicians who are on the stage of, look, you've just got to play with this, and you've got to try it out. And I tried it out. I tried out ChatGPT just before this panel, and said, what have all these people on this panel got in common? And we all like the beach. And they all laughed nervously, but I didn't get the sense that they had spent even 5 minutes that morning playing with ChatGPT. There are always a few, and sometimes unpredictable. In any band of politicians, any legislature, there are some who really get it. being an early tech adopter is not the prime skill you look for when you look in a politician. It is the ability to connect, to work out what people are caring about, and to do something about that and communicate that back. But they do listen, they know it's all there. But, you know, I think it's a bit unfair to ask them to be the prime movers in this. But what you're pushing out is, do they understand it? Well, they know they have to.
Do you feel then that that's evolving and changing? Are more government leaders trying to equip themselves with understanding?
Yes, this has been a long, long year. I think of Davos last year when ChatGPT had really burst on the scene, and in all these competitions to have sum up the year 2023 last year, in a word, many newspapers and listicles have reached for ChatGPT. It's not, a long year has gone by when people have experimented and have really tried to think, what is this going to mean for all kinds of things?
Yeah, and for context, tell our listeners a little bit more about Chatham House. I know any of our UK listeners will be extremely familiar with you, but for some of our global listeners, tell us a little bit more.
I wouldn't even assume that about UK listeners. So for all of them, Chatham House was set up the year after the First World War, 1919, and very much in that spirit of never again, can we bring rational thought and dialogue and getting people together to try to tackle some of the world's worst problems and at least make them a bit better, if not perfect them. And the famous Chatham House rule came along 8 years later when Chatham House was having a lot of these gatherings, and it said, we want people to be able to convene and talk in confidence that their words are not going to be pinned on them later. So the Chatham House rule says that you can draw on the information that you learn in a meeting, but you can't attribute it to any individual or any organization or even anything obscure like Western diplomats or so on. I get asked about three times a week on this, so you're very welcome. But that is what the rule is. And what we do now, we're about 200 people and then an awful lot of people associated with us as fellows and partners and so on. We're a think tank. And we do research, but we also do convening in public and private. And we try to bring together people, including people who don't like each other very much, and try to solve a problem, to move things forward.
And the Chatham House rule is very much the standard that's used here at Davos. It's often the standard for all sorts of multi-stakeholder dialogue as well.
Well, a lot of Davos, of course, is public. It's live streamed and they want the publicity. And I asked one Middle Eastern leader, have we been speaking under the Chatham House rule or do you want me to? Am I free to say anything? He said, tell the world. But much of what is discussed here, you're absolutely right, is private and is under the rule.
And since the advent of social media, does Chatham House rule actually truly still exist? Do people still honor it?
Yes, they do. Sometimes people interpret it differently, but not in Chatham House itself, they don't. So I can't speak for the whole world, because people tend to know about the rule, even if they don't know about Chatham House, which, if you're asking, is named after the actual building called Chatham House, and we're located there in St. James Square in London.
And we're always quick to correct people that it's rule, not rules, plural.
It is one rule. It is very slightly evolved during its time. So if you said rules, you would not be completely inaccurate, but you might be asked to come up with a history of it.
I'm glad no one has asked me to come up with that history, although maybe after we speak, I can do a better job of answering it. One of the findings that fascinates me about this year's Trust Barometer is looking at the expectation and hope that business will partner with government around innovation. It's a question we asked about a decade ago, and in the last decade, the number's gone up more than 10 points across the globe. People want business to partner even more with government on innovation. I'm curious for your reaction to that stat.
You know, it's a very abstract phrase, will you forgive me for saying? So I think if I were asked that in a questionnaire, I'm not quite sure what I would say. There are things that I want government to try and regulate, and AI, which we've been talking about, is one of them. But it's not going to be able to do it on a global scale, I don't think. You know, the genie is out of the bottle, and we've got many different systems already. You've got the UK, which is different from the European one, which is different from the US, which is different from the Chinese, and so on. What you want is some kind of control that in at least some parts of the world you can reach for. But you also do want the opportunity to be there. And I think that's also what people express they want from governments. And they're afraid that government's going to get it wrong in one way or another on these things. I think in other areas, though, they really do want government help. And I'm thinking of, I just had a conversation this afternoon about licensing medicines and how the pandemic actually didn't make this better. You might think that a big crisis like that would make the whole world reach for the same standard and say, we don't mind where you've tested your medicines. It doesn't matter if that's in Asia. Yes, you can come and license it in this country. But actually, the trend has been the other way. And countries have got more protective of their own standards, sometimes to prop up their own drug companies. And the US is now very much going its own way, and Europe is still a whole patchwork of different national systems. It's very hard to get one medicine license right across Europe. And here is where I think citizens really do want governments to step in and, for example, get them the medicines more quickly, more cheaply that are available increasingly, say, in the US.
What do you think is driving that move to more nationalism around patents or other forms of innovation?
It's a feeling of the need for security. I think you hear this a lot of different ways in government conversations, that more and more questions come back to security. And it feels like a very insecure world, both to governments and to the voters, in the case of democracies who put them there. And they want to do more to protect their country, people in it, their companies, and really with a feeling of being under pressure, less willing to go and risk their national assets, if you like. We're in less generous, more fearful times.
Do you feel that on a personal level, those government leaders are insecure themselves, or are they simply reflecting the mood of their constituents or their businesses?
I think they're reflecting a mood. And you can see it in many, many countries over migration. And you might get the finance minister or the chancellor in the case of the UK saying, look, we need quite a bit of migration to help the economy grow. You see voters saying, no, we don't see it that way at all. Please build us a wall or stop the boats or whatever the slogan is. That's just one aspect of it. But you can feel a lot of countries pulling in on themselves. And of course, we have the rhetoric of that in Donald Trump.
How does the work of Chatham House help flip that equation and perhaps get the conversations going that might lead to more multinational agreements or greater security for government leaders?
We're an international relations think tank. So what we're looking at is the relations between governments and companies, sometimes between societies and their governments, but we're just looking at the particularly relations across borders and saying, what can we do to make those better? So we're arguing against the trend I've just described, if you like. And some of that is arguing against the fear or pointing out the opportunity. Some of it is actually trying to broker those conversations. In the Middle East, getting several governments together who each say that they might want some kind of recognition of Palestinian rights as the way forward on the Israeli Hamas clash, but then they have very different views of what that might be. And so we try to tease that out in private. In tech, we're doing a lot on national government, just trying to push that to become more international. As I said, not global, because that may be too far. But on environmental things, I think we are helped by the progress that many governments have made in recent years to be more ambitious. And so whether it's on plastics treaties or on our food production or indeed on the big climate change negotiations, we encourage people to be optimistic, push for the numbers. Something always comes with a dollar or pound or euro sign, and that matters. We take the conversations, you know, back from one to the other and say, all right, and so what are you going to do? So we're not advocates always for any particular point of view, but we are advocates for solving these disputes.
Is there anything in your process or the way you convene people that would be helpful for our listeners to know in terms of here's what we see that works, that helps people kind of get beyond their own insecurity or their own fears or their own cautiousness and be able to have productive conversations that have meaningful outcomes?
It's framing the question in an open way that allows several different answers, and then putting it to people. And if they accept that that is a question that they can engage with, then essentially you've won that battle. It doesn't mean that you can push it through to some kind of resolution, but they have accepted that there are different points of view, that theirs is represented somewhere within that, and that there is something to talk about. So by the time you've got that far, you've won the battle for a conversation. And then it is really surprising what can come out of it. But you do need a desire to resolve something, and sometimes you just don't have that.
Can you give some historical context to this moment in time? So many people will say, the dialogue has never been so toxic. You've never had the different sides be so opposing. People won't even listen to another opinion. What's your take on that statement, and particularly with Chatham House being such a long-standing institution?
I've urged my colleagues never to use the word unprecedented. Most things have a precedent or have some kind of history. And to say the worst ever, or the more dramatic than ever, or indeed unprecedented, doesn't usually stand up to examination. So if you take, as you may be thinking of when you said that, the very divided state of US politics at the moment. But if you look back, I was growing up when I was tiny in Washington, D.C. during the Vietnam protest years, and my much older siblings were out on protests and stuff. Well, the country was very, very divided then. Is it different now? Well, yes, of course it's different, and it's about different issues, and the whole makeup of the American population is very different. Say unprecedented or worse than ever? No, I don't think it is, other than in the respect that you have a lot of people apparently questioning the result of the last election, and so that is new. That's the bit that gets at the standing of American democracy. But in the UK, people talk about Brexit being immensely divisive. It was, but now, some years beyond that, the 2016 vote, we're now in a much more practical phase, which is about taking pets over borders and what is the hold-up at the borders, using your passport and so on. Much, much more practical. And the UK is being able to find ways it can do its own thing, whether on Ukraine or vaccines or indeed on medicine licensing. So, again, try and talk people down from the sense of a crisis and a brink and a split like never before. Now, we do have some horrible situations in the world, and I don't mean to cry that at all, Ukraine, and the implications if Russia wins, in my view, in any sense of wins, are serious for the stability of Europe. The Middle East, the clashes going on at the moment, are many possibilities of that spreading. So I don't mean to decry those, but many, many states where people say, this is worse than ever, actually it isn't.
You mentioned these global crises, including the Ukraine and the Middle East. Are business leaders very focused on those in terms of what it might mean to their businesses and their futures?
It depends where the businesses are, where the business leaders are. So if you talk to big Indian companies, they were not remotely bothered about Ukraine. They said, look, that's a European problem. We regard it as a territorial dispute. It doesn't suit our government to take sides, nor us. But then the Middle East felt very, very close to them. A lot of workers from that country are there in the Gulf. It affects trade routes. It felt very intimate, and it felt like a completely different set of issues and ones that might spread. So I think it depends very much what the kind of business is. If you talk to businesses in services, they are focused very much on AI, and saying we have to get this right because we're in services and this really has a central effect on us. Businesses in manufacturing, much less so. So maybe that's just a way of saying many businesses are different, but they are, all of them, being forced to scan the planet for different threats and opportunities, and with a lot of uncertainty that they wouldn't have, all these wonderful strategy groups and forecasting groups probably wouldn't have put on their maps 5 or 10 years ago. And then they are having to look at these big themes, which we're talking about a bit, and sound very abstract. You know, what's going to happen with AI? What's going to happen with the environment? What's going to happen with migration? They're having to look at those they're almost unquantifiable, those things, and yet they're having to try and plan for their business. What does that mean? And so the degree of uncertainty is really, I think, having a, I'm not going to say paralyzing effect, but a sort of quietening effect. I've noticed that this year at Davos, a sort of hesitancy, a lot of questions. You hear people asking a lot of questions. But on the first morning, I thought the tone was absolutely unchanged. Everyone looked the same, sort of casual business dress with mountain boots. And I'd heard the word holistic 30 times before 10 a.m. on the first day. But as I've gone through it, just a bit more hesitancy about what really does this mean for me, for my activities, what I'm doing.
And that certainly would also, I think, lead to a good degree of insecurity as well. Looking at your home country, the UK, we found this year that the UK is the least trusting in institutions of the 28 countries that we surveyed. It's the first time that the UK has been dead last in the survey. What's your take on the UK's positioning in its trust in institutions?
The UK has had a drama going on out part of its government for these years, which has taken its toll on public trust. And it's been theatrical, and there's been these big figures which have impinged themselves on the attention of the whole world, whether it's Boris Johnson or briefly Liz Truss and so on. And I think that really has been to the cost of the nation's confidence. Brexit has not helped the nation's confidence, whatever side people took in it. The sense of, was this really what was intended? What were we promised? Can we hold people to account? That tentativeness has come in, though it is improving. And then you've had various clashes between the government and the courts, which really goes very deep. I think, even if people are not of a constitutional frame of mind, it is in all the papers, and people are thinking, you know, is our country really pulling itself apart? And we thought Britain was good at government, and it's something the country has prided itself on a long time. On the other hand, if you asked people even a few years ago, they would have worried about things that are not on the radar at the moment, like Scotland breaking away, Northern Ireland joining the Republic imminently. There was a lot of doubt about that. And actually, at the moment, a bit more of a cohesive feeling. And the monarchy, which sits there quietly in the corner, quietly, if telegenically, has probably had a bit of a role in knitting it all together.
Yeah, I was wondering, I mean, that is one thing that has changed in the year, is the change in the monarchy.
Absolutely. It brought the country together. Overwhelming majority. Even Republicans, many of them, Republicans in the British sense, many of them not being for the monarchy, missing the Queen and that whole era, though there were many who rushed in to say, look, you don't even have to watch The Crown to note some of the things that she perhaps did less well, one of them urging the marriage of now King Charles and Diana. But it brought the country together, and then there's a lot of support for King Charles. And again, these are not necessarily very royalist people that I'm talking about, but there's a relief in finding something, a strand of continuity in the country. You know, Britain is such a mixture, and I see this as someone who's lived there most of my life, but with a big American family as well. It lives on convention and tradition in many ways and has a big sense of its own history, and yet is capable of enormous change at the same time. The way Tony Blair did devolution of power to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, got rid of most of the House of Lords, all in a couple of weeks, really. The country can change, and change socially, as it has done on gay marriage and so on, very, very fast. So you don't always know which side of the UK you're going to get, the very tradition-bound side or the actually remarkably relaxed, confident and fast-changing side.
That's a great analysis, thank you. As we wrap up, some of the words that you used today include tentative, hesitant, insecure, but you also started in a fairly optimistic tone. So as you think of the rest of your week here, what's one thing that you're looking forward to that you can leave our listeners with?
I'm going to reach for the optimism in healthcare and in tech, in the way that with the first shock, if you like, of AI broken over the world, people now looking in a much more granular detail about what can this change? in a good way.
Great. I'm happy to end on that note. Bronwyn, thank you for being here today. Enjoy the rest of your week. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to our coverage from Davos of the Trustmakers.
Thank you for tuning into the Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.